Welcome back to Issues Etc. We'll spend the first half hour here in the final hour of the program with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. A couple things. The first thing is near and dear, I believe, to Uwe's heart because it deals with a scandal in journalism. Certainly you've heard about this. One Jason Blair has a long track record, it appears, of producing fabricated stories, less than true stories, and, well, and occasionally a true story, in the New York Times. And the New York Times bills itself as the newspaper of record. It is also a major source of news for other major newspapers as well, including our own local St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which admitted in today's paper, under the heading of media credibility, actually kind of tucked away there, that two of Jason Blair's inaccuracies in the New York Times were also presented to readers of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. So it had an effect. We'll talk about what it means for journalism, what it means for the New York Times with Uwe Simonetto, and we have several other subjects to deal with as well, including what the Roman Catholic Church is doing to try and rein in liturgical abuse, and Patricia Ireland as the new CEO of the YWCA. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Wonderful to be back.
Uwe, let's lay out what exactly Jason Blair did over time at the New York Times.
Well, Jason Blair went about quoting people he never interviewed. He ran around, got top coverage, but he actually sat in New York doing this. And he presented this to his readers and to his editors, and actually the editors are the ones who astonished me, as true coverage.
And how big of a deal was this in the world of journalism, that this would happen at the New York Times?
I think it's a very big deal because, especially since the New York Times is so sanctimonious about its own holiness, that it is to them. I mean, one hates to gloat here, but, you know, actually my heart goes out to this poor guy, Jason Blair, who must have been a very disturbed kid. What troubles me much more is that that the editors not only did not find him out, not only acted upon their own recognition that the guy was troubled, and you know, took a sort of fatherly approach that one would have in the past, when journalism was still a craft rather than a pseudo-intellectual exercise. And that they just continued doing this. I think that to me is really the scandalous thing. And that then you have the editor in chief saying, "Oh no, I wouldn't resign," and of course saying to the publisher, "I would never accept your resignation."
Okay, so what's going on here from the beginning to the end? It appears as though editors there at the New York Times, from early on, had some inkling that Jason Blair was producing fraudulent stories or stories that were less than true.
Right.
What exactly happened?
Well, what happened is they somehow closed their minds to it. They gave him occasionally a dressing down, saying, "Look, there have been too many corrections of your stuff." But they then kept on sending him out, you see, and until really the solids flew, and that is the main problem here. I think that is the actual problem. The problem is not that somebody screwed up. I mean, somebody, you know, some demented or troubled young reporter screwed up, as you would have demented and troubled young people screw up in other crafts as well, butchers or whatever. The trouble is that the problem is that these people were so convinced of their own holiness that this sort of thing could not happen in their minds, and so therefore, even if it did happen, it didn't happen. And that is something that is really has to be considered in today's media culture. We all screw up. I have screwed up. Everybody in our craft has, and some people have done worse than others. And this kid obviously has been appalling. But now, of course, they are pilloring him. You know, pictures all over their own paper and everybody else. But we don't see those extremely highly paid people who are lecturing the whole world on how to behave, somehow taking credit for what they've done. That to me is so terrifying.
Are you talking in particular about the Times managing editor, Gerald Boyd, or you mentioned him not by name, but...
The executive editor in particular.
Howell Raines.
Yeah. I think, you know, they all knew about this. The publisher must have known about it. In fact, I did read it. I didn't know about it. And somehow it wasn't stopped. And it is really, I'm not troubled by individual acts of folly or even criminal acts, if you want to call it that, remains to be seen. I'm terrified and horrified by the mindset that prevails in the only newspaper that survived the slaughter of New York newspapers in 1963, which I experienced. I was there when it happened.
Tell us how the process works here, Uwe, in being a print journalist for a long time. How does the process work from the story that is produced, the check for truth, the factual checks and those kind of things, until it actually lands on the front page or wherever it appears in the paper?
Well, I've never worked for the Times, but the way it would in all the other papers I worked for, you go, first of all, obviously the editor who assigns you must have some trust in you. And that means that you must have produced good copy in the past and not copy that is that obviously required correction all the time. That's number one. And that, you know, that you have enough experience. This kid was sent out on national stories well before he was ready for it. I mean, you know, you do have to have some experience to do that. Then the guy is set out. Then, you know, then he brings his copy in. I suppose there's a sub-editor running his story. And then it goes all the way up to whoever is finally in charge of putting putting the final product out. There are several levels of people who read this. I don't know exactly how it works for the Times, but when I was an executive editor of a newspaper, there were at least three or four, five different levels of people who actually checked the story and said, well, you know, something fishy here, it's not something not fishy. Obviously, you can't go around checking every quote or everything else, because you'd have to have thousands of people working for you. You have to have trust. In this particular case, they trusted a guy who was far too young, far too inexperienced, far too dry. He was heavy drinking, chain smoking, all that sort of thing that you associate nowadays, or you know nowadays, that somebody who does that is not a very experienced and settled, mentally settled character.
All right. Tell us about journalistic ethics. I work with a professional journalist. My producer is a graduate of a rather prestigious journalism school and has a career in that. And so I have a very small sense of how much accuracy of facts, plays in the mindset of the journalist. What beyond simple accuracy makes up kind of the ethical code for journalism?
Well, accuracy is, of course, one of them. The other ethical code, we're talking about reporting now, not commenting and that sort of thing. We're talking about straightforward reports and features. The next thing is you're not out. An ethical journalist is not going out to hurt other people. He's trying to be truthful. He's trying to be factual. He is not supposed to be prejudiced in one way or another, and most importantly, he is not the subject of his story. Somebody else is. These codes were violated here in this particular case. Obviously, it was somebody building a career for himself. Were editors who, for one reason or another, wanted to help him build his career, or actually feel holy about their own stuff, and what fell by the wayside were facts, and of course the very people about whom this guy Jason Blair reported, to whom we owe this to our interviewees, that were being factual, that we actually quote them correctly or try to quote them correctly. Obviously, everybody does make a mistake and one mishears somebody. But nevertheless, all these things have to be considered. It's disastrous, really.
Now, when you look at the world of journalism, print journalism, and we could expand this, of course, to the broader media as well, do you concur with what seems to be conventional wisdom that the media is biased in one way or the other?
Well, I wouldn't generalize that. There are some superb, hard-working reporters, and I would say those of us who still consider ourselves as craftsmen rather than pseudo-intellectuals will do so. There is a media bias, although, with the latest developments here, media bias might go in both ways. It might either go liberal left-wing or it might go hard right. But there seems to be that. But I would not generalize it to the point that you cannot actually get decent news and decent information around, because there are, I know, a whole lot of very, very fine journalists, especially out in the small towns and mid-sized towns, provincial newspapers, who are really trying to do their very best. There is some pressure on people who, instead of being reporters and craftsmen, suddenly become stars and command enormous amount, not only enormous salaries, but speaking fees and that sort of thing. There's an enormous amount of pressure to suddenly convert themselves into pundits and wise guys and geniuses and stars, which is not what we're all about. We're not supposed to be stars.
What is the well, let me come back to that. You mentioned journalism / celebrity.
Right.
How does that harm journalism as a craft? And what degree do you think that impulse played in Jason Blair's errors?
Well, it destroys journalism. It doesn't just hurt it. It destroys journalism. And the minute a journalist, the medium of information, becomes a celebrity, he ceases to be a journalist, he becomes a sort of great B-movie star or something like that. And ever since, I would say, since the 1960s and 70s, certainly since the Vietnam War, you have this tendency of certain journalists who actually seek celebrity status rather than being curious. And this is clearly what we might have found. Now, I'm not a shrink, and I haven't met Jason Blair. Actually, I feel very, very sorry for him. I think he's been a misguided character, and now, of course, with this thing, his career as a journalist has ended, rather than he underwent either pastoral care, or which would have been better, or medical treatment. For whatever might have troubled him, and so he'll never be, he'll forever be marked as the guy who did this, when in fact the people who should bear ashes on their heads are the editors in New York. So, but he obviously must have been tempted by this celebrity status. I mean, he was born into this appalling culture in which journalists are no longer craftsmen, but are celebrities, are being feted about, and then dropped. And the next thing is, you remember that there were times when people thought that Walter Cronkite should be president of the United States simply because his face was more familiar to everybody else than that of any of the presidential candidates. I mean, this is where we've landed. It destroys our democratic civilization.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the Jason Blair scandal at the New York Times, you can give us a call now. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe, what is the biggest problem in journalism today?
I think the biggest, well, there are many big problems. The biggest problem is that it's not so much that there is a lack of decent journalists. The biggest problem is the perception. You see, the instant news you get and instant information you get on television, and it is this stardom, which may not even be something that some people are striving for. There are wonderful journalists out there who become good television correspondents who suddenly find themselves as stars. To me, that is the main problem, and it is then to these people that politicians and media and stars, celebrities, and everywhere are catering, including criminals, rather than the traditional way of looking at the story, reporting on it, commenting on it, you know, separation of commentary and straight reporting fell by the wayside since the 1960s, since the new journalism was invented then. It is that. And it is the absence of... actually, the problem lies also with the population who no longer take time out to sit and read not just newspapers, whom tend to follow very often now the lead of television, but journals, excellent magazines, which exist, which all the internet. There's one enormous amount of information you can find there, and people don't do this. So therefore, we are now winding up as a society in which the only people who really have information to base sound judgment on are those who go beyond watching television or reading the New York Times.
Finally, on this subject, Uwe, what role in the best of all possible worlds, but what role should journalism, be it television, print, you name it, should it play in American society?
It should primarily play the role of informing the voting public. That is the role it should play. That's number one. Then, of course, yes, there must be analysis, there must be comment, all these things, because, you know, you have to help people find their sort out things. You know, if you're not an expert in sports, you know, you have to tell them what this means in terms of sports or politics or whatever. But the main role is to inform them as well as possible. Then, of course, you have also entertainment. There's nothing wrong with newspapers entertaining people, but it's primarily informing. That is.
Oh, I think we just lost Uwe Simonetta. We'll get him back here in just a second. Folks, if you'd like to join this conversation as we talk about this and several other subjects as well, the phone numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe, are you back there?
Yes, I'm back. I'm sorry, I had a disconnect here on my telephone. I'm sorry about that.
That's just fine. Let's see. Moving on to the next subject I wanted to talk about with you.
Right.
And going into this break, can you stay a few minutes after the break?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. What's going on since Vatican II back in the 60s with the Roman Catholic way of worship?
Todd?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, what's going on is what happened is that, you know, there were many interesting reforms in at Vatican II between 65 and 69. But the one thing, the very first thing that went wrong was that they tried to popularize worship. And what they did was in many ways destroyed the very beauty of liturgy that they had, that the Catholic Mass had, the Tridentine Mass. I'm not talking about the theological content now, that's another debate, but the aesthetic value and the way of worshipping things. And suddenly you had these priests strumming guitars. Suddenly they destroyed chancels of beautiful churches in Europe, ripped the altar out, moved them about. So now you suddenly see the pudding face of some pastor or priest, and, you know, the priest and the congregation worshiping each other rather than together worshiping Christ. And then, of course, the worst thing I think has happened to Catholicism is that they became mega evangelical by introducing trivial music. I mean, you go to a Catholic church, as I sometimes do in France, and I mean, you cringe at the lyrics and the music that they play, and you have somebody with a priest with a guitar, and, you know, everybody has to follow these songs. So everything is out of it. It is really like a low-level nightclub for Coca-Cola drinkers, you know.
And what is the proposed solution on the part of the Vatican?
Well, the proposed solution on the part of the Vatican, I mean, the Pope hinted at that in his latest encyclical letter, the Church of the Eucharist, Ecclesia, the Eucharistia, where he said, you know, they have to set strict standards and juridical standards also on how to pursue the Mass, so that it is not that you don't that not everybody can quote be creative unquote, but that you actually follow a set liturgy, hopefully with good taste and theological impact and meaning, and at the same time a return to the Latin Mass, which, as a Lutheran, I'd like to add, Luther never abandoned. In fact, in my hometown in Leipzig, until the end of the 18th century, the Latin Mass was still sung alongside other forms of the Mass. And if you travel about the world and you know some Latin, I mean, you know, you can learn 20 minutes worth of Latin. I think that they abandoned this was tragic indeed. Now it seems that they will return to the Latin Mass in addition to keeping the rest of it. Now, I just got some email by some furious priest who said there are only about 250,000 Catholics who would out of a billion who would want the Latin Mass. I don't think so. I think there are many more who liked the Latin Mass.
And this is a result of some reforms that took place, as you mentioned, during the Second Vatican Council.
Right.
What did the Vatican Council say that the Roman Catholic Church would be done with the Latin Mass, the Tridentine Mass?
No, it did not, actually. No, it did not. I mean, again, this was a misunderstanding. I mean, the Latin Mass was still continued, but there was more emphasis on the Mass in the vernacular. It's very confusing because actually I've heard Latin Masses sung, and not only among the integrists, I mean the traditionalist movement, but elsewhere, and in France, for example. But it simply is that the mindset was...
got about 30 seconds here, Uwe.
Yeah, the mindset was... it is not really the content that matters, it is not the style that matters, it is... pleasing to the lowest common denominator, which is bad musical taste.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation on this particular subject, an attempt on the part of the Vatican to correct some liturgical abuse in the Roman Catholic Church, and then our final subject with Uwe, Patricia Ireland and the YWCA. She's been named its new CEO. We've talked about it before here on Issues Etc. We'll get the take of our guest, Uwe Simonetto, after this break. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, I heard in the last hour during open lines from several Roman Catholics, and I'd like to hear from you as well, do you think this is a good move on the part of the Pope to say, look, Vatican II did not mean to bring about what has been brought about, sad to say, in many of the Roman Catholic churches when it comes to the liturgy, and this is a needed correction? Or maybe you think the reforms of Vatican II haven't gone far enough. Give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the moments left to us, I want to remind you folks that this is the opportunity. It's too late today, but it is not too late to order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. When we come back from this break, I'll tell you all about it. It's called The Spirituality of the Cross by Dr. Jean Edward Veith, and I'll tell you how you can order it online tonight or tomorrow during regular business hours. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc. Can we find a path to God through mysticism, moralism, and speculation? And what were the beliefs, teachings, and practices of the first evangelicals? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House, their phone number 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. The Spirituality of the Cross is written by Dr. Jean Edward Veith, culture editor for World Magazine. In this book, Dr. Veith details his journey through a variety of religious experiences and frustrations. The cost is $8.99 plus shipping and handling. The Spirituality of the Cross, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
Fossils. Evidence for Noah's Flood?
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the best-selling book, The Answers Book. Well, Ken, is there any evidence that fossils have formed quickly?
Well, this is a real important question. You see, the evolutionists teach that the fossil record forms slowly over millions of years. And I found that most people have the impression that therefore fossils form slowly over millions of years. Even many Christians believe this. But creation scientists believe that most of the fossils formed at the time of Noah's flood just 4,500 years ago. This means that fossils must have formed rather quickly. Well, is there any evidence that supports this? There sure is. I remember being in New Zealand and visiting a museum where they display a petrified ham. Now, it was formed after a village was covered by volcanic ash. I've also seen in a museum in the state of Tasmania in Australia a petrified hat. This is a miner's hat that was left in a mine, and after 50 years, well, it changed from being a soft hat into a hard hat. No, it doesn't take millions of years to make fossils. Actually, fossilization can be quite a rapid process, and most fossils formed during the flood of Noah's day just a few thousand years ago.
But doesn't carbon dating show that the world is millions of years old? For the truth, read our free booklet on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. You'll discover what true science teaches about the age of the Earth. The carbon dating booklet is available free at AnswersRadio.com.
It's 5:31. Good afternoon. Coming up, we'll continue with issues, etc. AM 850 KFUO weather. Mostly clear tonight, cooler with the overnight low of 45. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 69. Right now, it's mostly clear, a few clouds, 68 and breezy in St. Louis. In traffic, westbound 40 is heavy from west of Boyle out to Hanley. Then it's bumper to bumper, Brentwood through McKnight, and then Lindbergh heavy again, 270 out through Mason, and then also slow from the Chesterfield Airport out through Route K. Southbound 270 is heavy past 55 out to Telegraph. Northbound 270 between Page and Dorset Road. Traffic in the right lane is heavy, exiting onto 70. Westbound 70 is also heavy from the airport to Cypher. Stop and go from 270 out to the Blanchett Bridge. Slow across the bridge out to Mid Rivers. The normal volume of traffic heading towards the Poplar Street Bridge.
Artists from countries throughout the Caribbean, Central and South America are represented in a collection presented at the Missouri Botanical Gardens Ridgeway Center during its Folk Art of Latin America exhibit now through June 6th. The exhibition presents paintings on wood, canvas, and paperboard as well as on sculpted metal. Their work has been called charming, easy to understand and appreciate, refreshing, expressive, and spiritual. It speaks from the heart and soul. The exhibit is included with regular admission or membership to the Missouri Botanical Garden.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're having a little religious potpourri during this hour with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. Right now we're talking about liturgical abuse in the Roman Catholic Church with Uwe. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Tony's calling from his car. Tony, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon. I am a Catholic, and I'm very happy about this. I saw that there's supposed to be a papal document sometime later this year on the use of Latin, and I attend the Latin myself, and I'm very happy about it. I only hope that it actually is enforced if the document actually comes down. But I wanted to ask your guest if he had any knowledge about some of the news reports I'm hearing that Cardinal Hoyos is supposed to celebrate the Tridentine Mass at the Basilica of St. Mary Major on May 24th. And there may be some kind of reconciliation between Rome and the Society of St. Pius X. And if you had any knowledge about that, I'd appreciate it. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Tony, thank you very much for the call and for the question. Can you give us some background on this issue?
Yes, I can. Cardinal Hoyos has celebrated the Tridentine Mass in St. Peter's Basilica already. And I don't know whether, well, I'm quite sure you're right about St. Mary Major. It's a wonderful place to celebrate the Tridentine Mass. That is definitely the case. What was the second question? Sorry.
Well, he wanted to know whether or not this could bring about some reconciliation between those two branches of Roman Catholicism.
That is one of the purposes, I'm told. I mean, you know, I telephoned with the Vatican last week several times with friends of mine, contacts of mine in the Vatican, and people in the Catholic hierarchy elsewhere in the world, including in this country, and they said that this was one of the purposes, obviously, to bring, to reconcile the Lefebvre, the traditionalists, with Rome.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Uwe how he would appraise the Bishop Hansen leadership of the ELCA that was rebuffed in the intercommunion attempt with the Pope recently. And another question, does he think the Hansen leadership can pull off the formal homosexual takeover of the ELCA?
Good question, Herman.
Herman, it's a loaded question. Let me first get to the first one about the intercommunion with Rome. As you know, that the liberal wing of Lutheranism and then other forms of Protestantism, not just in this country but also in Germany, especially in Germany, in fact, are hankering after intercommunion, altar fellowship, even though there are still two totally different, or two different understandings of the meanings of the Eucharist, especially when you consider the union churches with whom people like Hansen and the German Lutherans are in communion. That is number one. So he's not going to pull it off. I think instead of, I agree with the Pope that communion or altar fellowship should be at the end of the ecumenical process, not at the beginning. First of all, we have to get our theology straight. Number two, I don't know whether Hansen is going to pull off this, this commission he's set up, are going to pull off this trick of homosexual ordination and a blessing of same-sex unions. If he does, I foresee a schism within the ELCA. My friends within the ELCA, I'm of course Missouri Synod now, but my friends within the ELCA are very certain that this is going to happen. We don't know how many ELCA congregations will then join the fall away group. That I can't say, and nobody really can. I mean, the numbers range from a few hundred thousand to more than 2 million.
I took the opportunity when I reported upon, via this program, Bishop Hansen's attempt to, he called it something like provisional communion sharing when he visited with the Pope, and the Pope did rebuff him, and I took the opportunity to commend the Pope for standing, but it seems like a tone-deaf move on the part of Hansen, especially given the publication of this latest encyclical from the Pope, the Church of the Eucharist, and what it has to say there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You see, we're not living in the age of ecumenism. We are living in the age of ecumenia. We're trying to gloss over differences instead of discussing them honestly and straightforwardly, and sitting down and seeing where we can obviously cooperate and where we can't. And we just throw everything out and say, okay, well, basically we like to be nice to each other. Nowhere in Scripture do you find a footnote even be nice to each other. Have an open debate, an open discussion. That's fine enough. But Hansen is. It's not just Hansen. It's this whole bunch of people in Germany and in Scandinavia and elsewhere who all try to make light of serious ecumenical differences and theological differences, which should be discussed. And Rome says quite correctly, this should be discussed. I fully agree with him. I don't agree with him on points of theology at times, but I certainly agree with him on this issue.
So what would you say, given that general critique, not only the leadership, but the general direction of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, what would you say to people within our church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who would think that we ought to become more like the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America?
I think they're nuts. Theater is absolutely crazy. It's demented. I mean, this is, look, if I may be crass, do we want to participate in this act of necrophilia that has been going on between the ELCA and the Episcopal Church? Two shrinking church bodies, two as dead as a dodo. I'm not talking about many very solidly Lutheran or Anglican Christians. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the institutions here. Why would we want to do that? What on earth is going on here? I don't understand it.
Is that part of the roadblock for someone like the Pope when he looks at the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as kind of promiscuous in its ecumenical activities? He says, well, if we warm up to you, we are by association warming up to the Reformed churches, and we are by association warming up to the Episcopal Church with which they're in communion, who is ordaining homosexuals.
Right. Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons, obviously, and also, you know, Cardinal Ratzinger, who is, of course, a keen observer, especially on what's going on in Lutheranism, because he knows them very well, and he's written extensively on Luther, and he certainly knows our theology. Cardinal Ratzinger can sit there and lean back and see how the quote mainline unquote Lutheranism is crumbling. They're throwing out everything, the doctrine of the two kingdoms, everything has gone out, our theology of the cross. And there are Roman Catholics who realize that they've been talking to the wrong Lutherans.
One question on the Pope before we move on to another subject. And by the way, folks, we are talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. And you are free to join us at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. The Pope turned 83 a couple days ago. He is mindful of his mortality. When this Pope does pass from this veil of tears, what will be his lasting legacy, both positive and negative?
I think his lasting legacy is that he has certainly been the apostle to the world, and especially to the young. He has... guided the church back to, from a Catholic point of view, obviously they're not Lutherans or they're not Episcopalians, they're Catholic. He's guided the church back to towards a sound theology. He has, at his age, I mean, to me this is always baffling to see this 83-year-old guy with spittle dripping from his lips and shaking like nobody's business, attracting all those young people. There must be a reason for it. Why? Because the guy has integrity, which I wish for a number of our Protestant denominations to show that much. I mean, I'm not saying Lutheran Church, so I say it, but I mean, we're talking about Bishop Hansen and others. The Pope has that. I think the negative thing to me is obviously the heavy, heavy emphasis on Mariology, and that to me is quite troubling. Because although he never said that Mary should be a co-redeemer, one has the feeling that that at least some of his speeches have encouraged that type of tendency. That is troubling. On the other hand, I do understand why he is very hesitant about getting closer to the Protestants who are self-imploding, it seems to me.
What do you think the next pope will be like? What's the process for choosing a new pope? And if you could prognosticate, obviously, with all the caveats in place, what do you think the next pope will be like?
Well, the process, obviously, that I think it's, what, 176 cardinals or something like that. I don't know how many have voting rights. I think it's 176 or thereabouts. Will then elect the next pope. It seems pretty, pretty clear that the next pope... Well, we have to see one thing. This particular pope has not been a very good administrator. I mean, the papal curia in Rome is in shambles. There is not that much discipline. What you need is a strict disciplinarian maybe an interim pope who, you know, an older man, but who can be rather rigid and rather strict in bringing order back into the church. But I'm quite sure that on the theological level, the pope's impact will last for centuries. I'm quite sure about that.
He is one of the longest tenured popes, of course. Are you saying then that he has, like perhaps few other popes in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, left his mark upon this, the greatest segment of Christendom?
I think so. More than anybody else, as far as I can think. Maybe with the exception of Gregory the Great or Peter himself, I don't know. But certainly more than anybody else, and certainly in recent history. And he is, as far as I can see, the most beloved of all popes.
Will the next pope necessarily be European? Is it possible we could get a Southern Hemisphere pope, or perhaps, not this time around, but maybe a couple turns away, an American pope?
Well, there will be, it's definitely possible that there'll be a Southern pope. I mean, an African has been mentioned, South American has been mentioned. I suspect it might be a European the next time around. There are even rumors that Ratzinger, although he's quite old by himself and not all that well, but that he might be one of the interim people who, because he has a way of disciplining people. But the next one could be would probably be Southern or Italian again, or Southern American, yes. But you know, I have my serious doubts that it will be an American that soon, simply because since America is the last remaining superpower, if an American were then also the leader of the largest institution in the world, that might be a little stiff. But you know, this is all speculation. It's very difficult. You don't know what dynamics are at work and will be at work during the next conclave when the next pope is elected.
The last subject I wanted to get your thoughts on, Uwe, for the sake of our audience, is Patricia Ireland being named CEO of the YWCA. What does this mean to you?
I sat there just laughing. I said, you know, it's like sort of making Jane Fonda the commander-in-chief of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I mean, one is totally baffled by this. Why would the YWCA still call itself Christian and then elect a woman who has been an ardent fighter for partial birth abortion and for abortion rights and for all causes, feminism, dividing mankind into along gender lines, and now suddenly she takes over an organization with 2 million young women. She is the one who's supposed to shape all that. I mean, I don't know what dementia has possessed those women who are running that organization.
Now, the response from the YWCA has been, look, she's qualified, but you say in a recent article, her qualification is not what you're questioning. What is it you're questioning?
I'm questioning why she would be a member or the head of an organization calling herself Christian when she is decidedly not a representative of what most of us would consider Christian. I think it is mislabeling something. You know, if you change the name of the organization into Young Women's Association, maybe just merge it with NOW, the National Organization for Women, that would be fine. I'm quite sure she would be an excellent chief executive of that. But what's Christian about it? She says she is into feminist spirituality, whatever that means, you know. Devil is spiritual, you know, devil worshippers are also spiritual. I mean, not that to say that she's a devil worshipper. And then she's heavily into this reimagining of God exercise, you know, where they have Eucharists with milk and honey celebrating female body juices. I mean, this, I don't know where we live and why not everybody is screaming with laughter over this. I mean, they should be laughed out of town. I mean, that's all you can say.
What do you think this signals for the future ideological direction of the YWCA?
It means that the YWCA will become another a junior version of NOW. And if you go through their website and type in any of the Christian keywords, you know, like gospel, Jesus Christ, the Bible, any of this justification. You'll get nothing. You get a blip saying this text is not here, you see. So that has been going on for quite some time. The ideological direction is going to be another feminist organization will shrink it somewhere along the line. A new YWCA will come along by another name. But what is much more important is probably that I see a serious rift between the YWCA and the United States, which by its own website is not Christian anymore, and by the election of its new leader, and the YWCA in worldwide, who have actually a Lutheran leader who is from Kenya, who is very much a Christian, and I wonder how long these two organizations can cohabit. I have my serious doubts there.
Diane Nippers, she's president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, suggests that some truth in advertising is in order. Tell us about that, and what do you think of the suggestion?
Well, she just says to drop the Christian out of YWCA. Just make it YWA, and then it's fine. Then you're honest. Then Patricia Ireland is certainly welcome to doubtless substantial salary.
And what do you make of her suggestion?
I think she's right.
This is a concern that I think probably would have, and many people would have, but tell me if you believe it to be too alarmist, that this is simply the tip of the iceberg, that feminists, be it in academia or politics, or now in the case of public social institutions, are seeking to institutionalize radical feminism and to put it in the crassest terms, take over American culture and society.
Not only American culture and society, world culture and society, together with the homosexuals, sure. My only hope is that as I'm observing this culture, I'm not American, but I have been a keen observer of American culture. I seem to see a swing away from that. I think if you look at that applies to Europe, by the way, as well, the next generations coming up, you'll find that strident feminism is withering away. I think that's the one thing we owe Monica Lewinsky. When these women's organizations became supportive of President Clinton, I think they actually pulled the plug on themselves.
It has also been observed by someone else that this is this was called the coming out of the YWCA as a cash cow, and the term there was cash cow, I think, for radical feminism. Do you see any connections there, money-wise?
I don't know if it's money. Yeah, it's all connected with money. Otherwise, why have such an organization? It's a combination of. Look, it's all part of the me culture, me woman culture, me as opposed to you man culture. And in that sense, they're probably foolish enough to believe that they're going to make money that way. As I'm observing this civilization, this culture, I feel that the American women that I come across nowadays, and especially the younger ones, are shedding this nonsense and are moving on to a much more normal lifestyle and more normal approach to the other sex. They may see it as a cash cow, I'm quite sure they do, but I don't think they're going to succeed with that.
If someone looks at feminism and the move by the YWCA and says, look, here's a perfectly good Christian organization that has credentials in the past of being a Christian organization, it's now been secularized, have they misrepresented what's going on here, or is there something else? You mentioned that this is kind of that Patricia Ireland has her own form of spirituality, a feminist spirituality.
Yeah. Well, she says she has. I mean, I can't make out what that is. I can't make out the word spiritual anymore because I don't know what it means. I mean, it's misrepresented. It is. There is a general sense, obviously, that there is a spiritual dimension to life. And so then, of course, you have all these other forms of spirituality, including Wiccan and good earth and God knows what else. In the end, it amounts to peanuts, because, I mean, how many Wiccans and how many good earth types do you have as opposed to believing Christians of the various denominations? And look who is actually out there doing something. It's not Wiccans. I mean, it is the Christian churches in the end. So, and you know, actually, if you look at church attendance and sort of binary with what people believe, you'll find that that this quote spirituality unquote doesn't amount to peanuts. It is in the end what matters is a belief in Jesus Christ and in serving God, and I think that is going to prevail. And so, therefore, let the YWCA either give themselves a new name, Or let the members rebel against this if they are still believing Christians and they want to, they don't want feminist leadership, then they have to rebel. It's their business. But I think it's very sad considering the tradition of this organization and the marvelous accomplishments in the past.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. One can take a little survey, a little walking tour of the news with a guy like Uwe Simonetto and be left sometimes more baffled, more confused, and more troubled by what one sees in society than they were before. And that's the nature of living in this world, isn't it? Jesus never said it would be easy to live with one foot in one kingdom and the other foot in the other kingdom simultaneously under two governments, both being ruled by God through different means to different ends. The government of the left hand, the civil world, through force and reason, toward the end of simply keeping people from killing and eating one another, keeping law and order. And the kingdom of God's right hand, which has its ultimate purpose in the salvation of sinners, ruled not by force or reason, but by the Word of God, in particular, the gospel of grace and mercy, forgiveness of sins in Jesus Christ and Him alone. This isn't easy. This is not easy to do. However, in the midst of, as you live in these two kingdoms, I would like to offer you once more a bit of a guide, if you will, that features a clear exposition of this two-kingdom teaching as part of its exposition of the spirituality of the cross. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. It's by our regular guest, Dr. Gene Edward Veith. The book is called The Spirituality of the Cross. The cost of the book is $8.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order the book tonight online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the spirituality of the cross. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, called The Spirituality of the Cross by Dr. Gene Edward Veith. That toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. Or order it online tonight at issuesetc.org. Go to the What's New section, and you'll find information on this book. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues Etc. broadcast was partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Spirituality of the Cross, by Dr. Gene Edward Veith. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month, The Spirituality of the Cross. Here's news from your St. Louis Science Center. You can experience the thrill of unearthing dinosaurs in PaleoTrek 2003, a fossil dig in Garfield County, Montana, sponsored by the St. Louis Science Center and the Eastern Missouri Society of Paleontology. 2 week-long trips are scheduled for June 17th through the 14th and June 21st through the 28th. The first expedition is open to anyone over age 16, while the second is reserved for educators only. Call the St. Louis Science Center for more information on PaleoTrek 2003.